Take a network break. Last week, we announced Bitcoin, a virtual donut-based cryptocurrency, and I'm pleased to announce that a single Bitcoin is now worth 1 billion virtual donuts. So for those of you who got it on the ground floor, congratulations.
Congratulations. Oh, what a CAGR, capital appreciation growth rate.
It's hockey stick. Hockey stick.
It's gonna really take off after this.
I'm Drew Conroy Murray. The other guy on the microphone is Greg Farrow. This is our weekly 100 meter dash through tech news. We've got a lot to cover, so let me get rid of some business first. This episode is sponsored by Cisco and White Spider. You can listen to Priority Queue episode 137 to hear real world examples of how customers are using Cisco ACI to automate their data center networks. Just search for Priority Queue 137 at packetpushers.net, and you can learn more about the case studies discussed in the podcast at whitespider.eu/packetpushers. And mark your calendars for Tuesday, March 20th. That's coming up. The Packet Pushers are going to host a live online virtual design clinic. This is an event developed and curated by the Packet Pushers. It's got a mix of independent and sponsored presentations. We're going to tackle real-world network design challenges. You can find out more at packetpushers.net/VDC. All right, to the news. Greg, you're always pointing out that Cisco likes to abuse its resellers, and now the Register's reporting that Cisco may start selling some products directly online, and they're going to test it in Australia and New Zealand.
There's a few things to this. I don't know if Cisco likes to abuse its resellers, but I think it just ends up doing it. It's the old, you know.
It just can't help.
It just can't help itself because they're so focused on the deal, and, you know, they want to touch customers directly because you wouldn't want to lose a deal because the reseller did something that, you know, that sort of stuff, that I don't think it's actually deliberate. It just ends up, that's the way it goes. You end up mucking things around and everybody gets unhappy. So I don't think it's deliberate. It's just part of the way that Cisco runs itself. And remember, I say to you that long term, I don't see the reseller business staying the way it is today, because ultimately the resellers who are doing tin shifting destroy the market for those who want to focus on professional services. And the obvious way to fix that is, you know, either get rid of the partners who just want to shift tin and get short-term cash flow before they go broke usually. Or, you know, if you're trying to build a professional services business, you really actually don't want to handle the cash flow problems of buying Cisco's assets and moving them to the right. So I think long term, you're going to end up with customers that will buy assets direct from Cisco, and then they'll be integrated by a business partner.
Yeah.
The long term question there that I haven't got sorted out in my mind, that I don't think there's an answer, this is an evolutionary thing, is that Cisco might sell the products direct to the customer. Whether they'll sell the reseller through Cisco, so, you know, quote a business and then the reseller gets a percentage, or whether the reseller then sells their professional services direct to the customer, that's yet to work itself out. But Australia is the market where Cisco does test these ideas. So when Cisco wants to work out different sales models or try out different sales models, it does try in the Australian market first before deciding whether to take them onwards to other locations, particularly the US, where the bulk of its revenue is earned. So this wouldn't surprise me in any way, shape or form. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out and whether it does actually make it out. Like, are companies really willing to go out and buy direct? Will customers actively seek it out? That's what they want to test, I guess.
Yeah, well, it sounds like based on the story in the Register, they're going to start off with small business products, so probably products that don't have a big margin anyway, make them sell for online. Yeah, just sort of test the waters with probably inexpensive products and see how it goes. Things that may not need a lot of initial configuration and so on.
The question, though, is if you do it at the small scale, and let's say a handful of small businesses, you know, if you do it at something small, that doesn't necessarily translate to the big, because there's a massive gap transition in the market between somebody who's spending $2,000 on a firewall or they want a three-node network with Meraki. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It's a bit different from somebody who wants to spend $500,000 on a data center switching infrastructure.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. It's a different model, different way you want to approach and touch the customer. So maybe there'll be sort of tiers or segments of the kind of products that will go online and will stay sort of behind that sales wall.
It costs a lot of money to do this stuff, right? Because you think about the middleman, you have Cisco's manufacturing it and then warehousing it. Then it has to shift it into a distributor in the country of destination. So they out of the Cisco warehouses into the distributors in Australia, who then ships it to the reseller, who then ships it to the customer. And that's just not an acceptable business model in 2018. All those middlemen are all taking a whack.
That's right.
Basically just to, you know, clock it in and clock it out of their warehouses and to basically have all that money. So if you spend $500,000 on networking kit, everybody's taking 10 to 20% on the way through.
Right. Yeah. So the money has to go around.
That's right. So if you really want to get to a cloud situation where really what you want is just to rake the revenue out of the licenses where they're being hosted in the cloud, You want to get away from this idea of all these middlemen. You just want to sell them the hardware at the cheapest, fastest possible way. And really what Cisco needs to bank on is this cloud revenue. And you're seeing this with the, you know, we've seen presentations from Contrail, HPE starting to do cloud services. Dell's all about, is still focused on the hardware so far. I haven't seen them get into cloud, but Cisco says, we're going to have a business model that looks like Amazon, but isn't going to be Amazon. We're not going to build data centers for a living.
Right.
And the way they're going to do that is host services in cloud and then charge licenses to access those, like Viptela's cloud service, like some of the products that we're talking about today, what they've done with the Cisco Intersight product and so forth, and what they've done with security, like especially in the security products with their scanners and analyzers and the online DNS services and all that sort of stuff. That's the business that Cisco's targeting for growth. And getting rid of the middlemen for shipping the 10 when you need to, well, that's one way to focus on that growth of that market.
That's right. Well, we'll definitely keep an eye on this and see how it plays out. Interesting that Australia is the testbed, and they don't have any firm timeline on when this is going to happen, but we'll keep an eye out and see what more we can learn.
Yeah, the Register article is basically saying somebody made a comment in passing at a conference somewhere, so it's not exactly an official.
I think it was a Cisco Live Melbourne.
Yeah, so we'll see.
We'll see. All right, we've got some other Cisco news. The company announced two new products that target the WAN. The first one is SD-WAN V Analytics, and this was originally in development at Viptela, which you'll all remember that Cisco acquired. That's an SD-WAN company. It's a SaaS application. It collects data from Viptela devices, and then customers can use it to analyze potential policy changes to see how it might affect performance or get insight on how to improve their existing performance and also anticipate your bandwidth requirements, like if you're rolling out a new branch or bringing on a new application.
So my original predictions from, you know, way back talked about this, about how everything had to be analytics. We had to have visibility. We have to see what's going on. Because everything in the WAN, you remember about a year ago, I was making predictions along those lines. And this is what we're seeing, is this online service that matches with the commitments that Cisco's given to its shareholders. And you can rent this to monitor your WAN bandwidth, your SD-WAN service. And Viptela had built quite a powerful tool that customers did like. And yeah, this is where it's at.
I mean, it makes sense to you've already got a device there. You're tracking performance and getting other metrics out of this device that's measuring WAN performance. So why not aggregate it, analyze it, and provide some extra value from it?
Yeah, exactly. What it also does is shift the discussion around SD-WAN away from routers and protocols and, you know, all that sort of stuff, and away from the idea of buying the router to we're providing you with a turnkey solution. So Cisco's moving up the stack here.
They're moving up the stack, and they're also saying this is not just about connectivity. It's we're helping you solve sort of business problems as well.
That's right. That allows you to upsell. And then from a revenue point of view, it actually allows you to take back the market share that they've been giving away for the last 20 years to third parties. So we've seen plenty of companies in that space, from Spiceworks to SolarWinds to, you know, all of the network monitoring companies that are all now, they have to compete with Cisco head on with these analytics tools. Like, look at what they've done with Tetration. And we talked about Tetration last week or the week before. Mm-hmm. We've got SD-WAN V Analytics. We've got ACI building its analytics platforms in. In fact, one of the things that's getting a bit confusing is how do these all go together? I mean, how many of these are actually overlapping is one of the thoughts that I had.
That's a good, yeah. I'm sure they're working on some grand single pane of glass, and I'll put a quarter in the jar for saying single pane of glass analytics platform to rule them all, but that's probably still a work in progress.
That's right. That's right. But it's one of the things that I've always wondered, why didn't Cisco do this, you know, network monitoring software? Why have they always just left it to somebody else instead of getting into this market? And now that they've suddenly decided that they're a software company, well, guess what?
That's right. All right. The other product they announced is Meraki Insight. This is a software add-on to your Meraki dashboard, and it brings WAN application performance metrics into the dashboard so you can see what's going on in the WAN and help with troubleshooting. You have to note that it's coupled with the Meraki MX appliance that sits out of branches as a security appliance and does some SD-WAN features, and that acts as the data collector to feed into this Insight application.
And same thing. So this is how do you get more money out of your existing customer base in Meraki's when you put some icing on the cake and sell them some fries with that?
That's right.
And so why this wouldn't be part of the existing Meraki, why it has to be a chargeable extra is a discussion for those of you who would on what level or line of cynical and profit you want to get down on. Because it's not that hard to build a WAN monitoring platform, let's face it.
Sure. But it's there if you want it, if you're a Meraki customer and you're using that appliance. All right, staying with SD-WAN for a minute, there's new data from the research firm IHS Market that puts VeloCloud at the top of the SD-WAN pile in terms of revenue earned in the fourth quarter of 2017. SDX Central posted a chart, and in that chart, VeloCloud captured just over $28 million in SD-WAN revenue for the quarter from a total pile of $146 million, and that puts it at the top of the stack.
I'm having troubles with this one, Drew. I don't know about you. What do you think? Do you think this sounds – does this pass the sniff test to you?
Well, SD-WAN revenue is so opaque at the moment. So tell me what you're sniffing.
Rubbish.
Okay.
If you sort of think about, I mean, the challenge here is how you define SD-WAN. So if you have a look at the vendors here, Vela, Cloud, Ariaka, well, is Ariaka an SD-WAN company or is it something else? Like I saw Ariaka 5 years ago was selling themselves as a WAN acceleration, a cloud WAN acceleration.
Right.
So if you're going to say they're pulling 25 million of SD-WAN, but I don't see Ariaka that much out there in the market that I've heard of people. I know a few people using it, but I always had the sense that Ariaka was sort of the same size as Riverbed or Tulare.
I was very surprised to see Ariaka coming in at the second place here with 24 million in revenue. So
that sort of put a bit of a sniff test thing out there. I know VelaCloud, I think VelaCloud has good, that number looks about right. Silver Peak looks right. Cisco looks about right. InfoVista, I've never even heard anybody mention the word InfoVista in SD-WAN before.
Yep, I was not aware of InfoVista, that's right.
No, so, you know, are they actually selling SD-WAN? I thought they just did network monitoring, so. Oh, Ipanema. All right, they rebadged Ipanema. So maybe they do. Okay. Sounds to me like they're taking all the revenue from some product that was something a bit like Ariaka. Our total revenue, because we're now an SD-WAN company, but maybe some of that revenue is doing other things, shall we say.
Right.
Even if you take the whole thing, right, the Riverbed number looks too low, 2.5 million looks a bit low to me. I've spoken to them and I had a sense that they were much larger than that, given how much money they're spending on that business. So but they're saying all up, IHS Market is a company, is an analyst company that spends its whole time measuring the size of the market. So 150 million, that's suggesting that the whole of the SD-WAN market is a $600 million run rate business.
Right. In 2017. Mm-hmm.
At the end of 2017, that doesn't sound right either. Not if you go off to IDC and Gartner, they're all predicting that SD-WAN will reach 8 billion in 2021.
That's right.
So if you start thinking about that, you're saying we're going to grow from 600 million in 2018 to 3 years, it'll be an $8 billion market. No.
Well, we should say those are two different analyst firms, but yes, these kind of market speculations can be all over the place.
Yeah, I just found this a little odd, to say the least. So like I'm not disputing that, you know, for what definition of SD-WAN, the competency of the analysts and their process that was involved in this, it's hard to say without having to pay a substantial fee to get access to it. And that could mean that my perception of the market is wrong, or it could mean that the people involved haven't got a good grip on what SD-WAN really means. And I can't tell you one way or the other. You'd have to make your own judgment.
Well, we've got links in the show notes if you want to go look at it for yourself.
Good luck making sense of it.
Yeah, that's up to you. Quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, White Spider. They are a Cisco Premier Partner, and on Priority Queue episode 137, the Packet Pusher sat down with Cisco and White Spider to talk about ACI, and that's Cisco's data center automation platform. ACI promises to transform data center networking through greater automation and operational efficiency. And the podcast dove into how ACI can meet these promises. They used examples from customers running ACI in production. They debunk the myth that ACI is a complex beast. And they also talk a little bit about SD Access, which is ACI's counterpart in the campus. So if you want to learn more, you can go to packetpushers.net and search for Priority Queue 137 to hear the episode. And of course, you can also go to whitespider.eu/packetpushers. That's whitespider.eu/packetpushers to learn more about the case studies that they talked about in that podcast.
It was a good podcast. Good fun.
Yeah.
And they did well to explain all the hard stuff.
It's always nice to have customers talk about it.
Yeah, real people who really have a, you know, motivation to make it work.
That's right. All right, back to the news. We've been talking about the ongoing Broadcom bid to swallow Qualcomm, and that effort is now on hold because a U.S. government agency is reviewing the national security implications of the acquisition.
Yeah, so this is not entirely unsurprising in the sense that what would you expect them to say?
Well, yeah. you mean the U.S. government or?
Yeah, that's right. So you're sort of looking at this. I was looking at this thinking to myself, you know, that makes sense because Broadcom really wants to get into Qualcomm, but Qualcomm has a long history of, you know, using a strong position with the government to make sense of what it wants to get out of things. And I did sort of feel that, you know, they were going to do something, like Qualcomm was going to fight back. They don't want to be taken over at all in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
And this doesn't surprise me in that sense. So I guess it's going to be an interesting fight to see how Qualcomm keeps fighting back against Broadcom over time. And, you know, even today there's maneuverings and changes, and Broadcom's getting seats on the board because it's got X number of shares and it's allowed to do so.
That's right. Broadcom's being very hostile and trying to, you know, boot the Qualcomm board to get some Broadcom proponents onto Qualcomm's board. So looking at the story, the agency we're talking about, it's the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. It's part of the Treasury Department. And sort of the rationale that they're taking is that if Broadcom does buy Qualcomm, Broadcom may have an incentive, after having spent hundreds of billions of dollars, to slash R&D spending, which would then imperil the development of 5G technology in the U.S. And the U.S. feels like it can't fall behind, particularly China, in the development of 5G. And so they're going to take, I guess, a close look at this and see what the consequences may be.
Yeah, you can just see a bunch of execs sitting around a room going, what's the best story we can tell to get a better price for our shares? Because, you know, Qualcomm wants to see the bid price at $90 to $95. And Broadcom only wants to pay, I think, $75 or $70 or something like that. And so I think it's as much as of a negotiation to get the price up. There is a price at which Qualcomm will sell. And I just get the feeling that this is just, you know, what we can do is we can get the government to spike the deal. And, you know, we'll fight it all the way back by saying it's in the national interest to have 5G develop, you know, and that'll get the share price up. I don't really think, you know.
Are you saying this is just about money? I'm shocked.
It's always about the money, sir. You know what I'm talking. Whenever I'm talking about anything here, it's always about the money.
All right. Well, that's definitely a story we'll keep an eye on. We got some more market numbers for you. IDC released their Q4 and full year 2017 analysis for worldwide Ethernet switch and router markets. Here's a few top line numbers. Ethernet switches generated $6.9 billion in revenue worldwide in Q4 and totaled $25.7 billion for all of 2017. On the routing side, enterprises and service providers generated $4 billion in Q4 and $15.2 billion for the year.
So $4 billion of total $6.9 billion in revenue. Mm-hmm. So guess who's the dog wagging that tail in that fight, right? I also notice in the results that they're also talking about that Cisco still dominates with a 53% market share. But remember, a few years ago, they had like an 80% market share of Ethernet switching. And IDC reports a 1.4% year-over-year decline. So even though Cisco's bounced back in the last quarter, predicting growth and rises overall for 2017, they shrunk quite substantially.
It's a slow eroding, and you can just see it happening quarter after quarter. I mean, owning 55% of enterprise market for Ethernet is still pretty good, but watching that number shrink and shrink every year, it's got to be disconcerting for Cisco.
Yeah, I think they're, and this is why they're driving into the software market, as we talked about earlier. They, you know, as a switching market dries up, what do? You put some ice cream on top of the pancakes and you start selling extra creamy, double delicious ice cream at $2 a scoop on top of your $2 pancakes. And that's SDN for Cisco, really. I think the other story here was the 100 gig part. There's some pretty interesting line items here about 100 gig.
Yeah, they had strong growth, and they're now accounting for just under 10% of the market, 100 gig switches.
Which is extraordinary, because that's up from, that's like, it says here in the report, up from just 4.8%. So double 100 gig sales is now 10% or 1 in 10 ports. That's really distorting the market. So if you're trying to buy 10 gig or 40 gig, the 40 gig market's pretty much drying up because all of the production capacity switched to 100 gig. You wouldn't be producing, you know, you wouldn't be building more manufacturing capacity around 40 gig when you know it's dead in 2 years, 2 to 3 years.
That's right. Yeah, and 25, 50 gig switches also topped 1 million ports shipped, and that's having an impact on 40
gig. Yeah, so I know people in the enterprise still haven't gotten off 1 gig yet, and they're still thinking about moving to 10 gig. But as I've always said, start thinking about 25 and 50 gig and just skip 40 gig completely if you can manage it. I know that Cisco and Juniper are still selling the legacy speeds, but they're already obsolete. You really, if you're going new, you want to start getting away from 40 gig if you can manage it. Even if you've got custom proprietary FIs like what Cisco's got with their 40 gig single one cable solutions.
Just to wrap up some numbers, we mentioned Cisco holds the top spot in terms of market share. Huawei's in second place with 10% market share in Ethernet switching. HP and Arista tied for third. They both get 5.9%, but here's this interesting number. Arista saw its Ethernet switch revenues jump 40% over the year from 2016 to 2017, and that's double the kind of revenue that HPE is pulling in.
Yeah, it's funny. I wonder if, I thought Aruba was doing quite good sales in the campus with their switches. I wonder if that's counted in there or whether it slipped outside of the, you know, is this more data center or is this, it's just, it says we're just looking at Ethernet switches and routers, so it doesn't make sense.
Well, I mean, HP has the same market share as Arista. It's just that Arista seems to be getting more revenue out of every switch it sells as opposed to what HPE can pull in.
Still nervous time at Arista because a lot of those vendors are those cloud scale companies, which represents like 40% of its revenue we talked about last week.
Right. And once those big 100 gig switch sales cool, that may hurt.
Yeah. We're seeing the rise of the OCP, like with the Trident 3 and the Jericho 2 chips. I'll talk more about Jericho 2 in a separate post this week, in the next week. But those chipsets basically mean that you can actually build a 1RU that does most of the work of these big of what takes an Arista chassis today. So there is some threat to their business models.
Okay. All right, something we'll keep an eye on. Another quick break to tell you about our Packet Pushers Virtual Design Clinic. And Greg, you can give us more information.
Yes, we've decided that we would like to put a conference together, but instead of actually holding it in person where only a few of you can get there, we're going to just do it online. And the idea is to try and emulate the conference experience as much as possible. So they'll be chatting, just like you, when you get to a conference, you get to chat in a corridor and say hello to people around you. We're going to simulate that. We'll have people in chat rooms that you can chat, talk to and ask questions and have discussion amongst yourselves and talk about what you're doing. So it'll be a two-hour Ask Me Anything session with Packet Pushers. I'll be there, and we have recruited a bunch of special guests from people that we know that you can ask. And then we've got 2 hours worth of presentations. We've got Matt Oswalt talking about coming at it from an independent point of view, and Peyton Maynard Coren is going to talk about how to build a network from his point of view. He's got a really interesting take on how enterprise networking should look. And then we have some sponsors from Glueware and ThousandEyes talking about their products and how they would come at the design products for the enterprise data center. You'll be able to interact with peers, including me and Ethan and Drew and a range of other people that you'll have heard on the podcast over the years, be able to ask questions live and people will answer you. And it's free. You don't even need to leave home. You don't need to go to the boss and ask for budget. You can even join the conference from the bathroom. Well, the kitchen, the staff room.
You don't have to tell us where you're joining from. Just come on over.
And it's free. So all you've got to do is head over to packetpushers.net/VDC. And there's some details there about the timings and all that sort of stuff. In this case, we're going to start at 10 a.m. Eastern U.S. time. We know that there's lots of people in Europe and in the Pacific regions who'd love to join. And yes, we have plans to run more of these events this year, and we are going to time shift them into your zone so that you can get to join at a good time.
At a more reasonable hour.
1 a.m. Australian is not necessarily the most convenient time for people to join on in.
Right? Could make for some interesting questions, but.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. After a bottle of whiskey, join in for the show.
So go on over to packetpushers.net/VDC. You can sign up there. You can also get more details. It's Tuesday, March 20th. That's coming up. So we hope to see you there.
That'd be great. We'd love to have it a successful run so that we can do these more often.
That's right. All right. You've heard of ransomware. You know how it works. They encrypt business files, hold the files cryptographically hostage until someone pays a fee to get them decrypted. There's a new survey from a security company called CyberEdge, and it found that half the ransomware victims who paid the money didn't actually recover their files.
So those of us who are closer to the front here know that very rarely you get money back from get your data back after you pay the ransomware, because if I was actually to give you back your data, you might be able to backtrack it and trace me down. So it's actually a serious risk. So half of them to give you their data back is actually a surprise. I would have thought it was like 1 in 5.
I was very surprised too that half of the people who paid, the criminals actually gave them the tools to help to decrypt their files. Those are very scrupulous criminals.
I guess the flip side here is that you don't want to, poison the market. Because if you don't give the data,
we can't sully our reputation.
Yeah, if it becomes well known that you're not going to get the data back, they wouldn't pay. So I guess there's a delicate balance here where on one hand, you want to be able to make some money. On the other hand, you're going to be at risk. So maybe they are thinking ahead and saying, I've got.
There's some real interesting market forces at work here, aren't there? Like, I've got to, demonstrate that I'm the most reputable ransomware hijacker you'll ever meet. I've got an A+ yes. rating in the Better Business Bureau.
That's right. I stole your data, but
100% service guarantee.
It's a 50-50 shot. You'll get it back if you pay my ransom. So I just, you've got to run a business. You have to have a reputation for paying it. And it only takes a few blog posts saying, yes, I paid it the ransom and I got my data back. And you've got yourself a functioning market. Whereas if you have a few blog posts saying I paid my ransom and got nothing, then people will stop paying. So I guess it makes sense, doesn't it?
Capitalism at work.
Simple self-interest.
That's right.
Always a winner.
We often cover financial results here, and of course, we've got Dell Technologies now. They've reported their Q4 and full year 2018 fiscal results. They posted revenues of $21.9 billion for the quarter, which is up 9% year over year, and an operating loss of $321 million for the quarter. For the full year revenue, that was $78.7 billion, with an operating loss of $3.3 billion.
So still losing money substantially from the look of it. And considering how much debt they're sitting on, you know, we've heard stories of $40 billion worth of debt still waiting to be paid down. The issue, we talked 6 to 8 weeks ago about Dell backing into a reverse listing on the stock exchange with VMware.
That's right.
Among other ideas, you know, with, they're trying to go back for a relisting so that they can clear down some of that debt. I imagine that if they were to clear down that debt, that would be a nicely profitable business.
It really does seem like it. You read the press release from the executives and they talk about velocity of growth, which is a nice way of saying we haven't made any money yet, but we're speeding toward profitability.
Yeah, we're growing.
Yes.
Yeah. But I think Dell's got a very interesting business model. They still seem to be focused on the shifting 10 and letting other people sell the software and the services on top, which is the very traditional business model, but it certainly seems to be eating the market. I mean, they're equal, their server share or their server volume sales is equivalent to HP and like still 10, 20 times what Cisco's selling in the service space. Cisco's server sales are actually quite small, despite Cisco's bombast about how much they, you know, about their whole thing. So it's fairly interesting to see that they're still growing. They had really good revenues. And of course, part of it's due to RSA, VMware, and Pivotal to some extent as well.
Well, actually, those VMware is contributing $2 billion, I think, in the quarter, which is pretty good. But Virtustream, RSA, and the others, they don't even break them out individually because as a total, it's just it's under $500 million for all those businesses combined. So they don't bother to break that out. They are doing well in client solutions. That's their PC business. That grew 8% for the quarter, which is pretty good for PCs. Infrastructure grew 5%. And if you look deeper in that, networking and servers was up 27% for the quarter, which is great. But it's storage that's slipping.
And that's no surprise. EMC storage is really well behind what competitors have done. And that's a really busy market, the storage market. EMC really has sort of ended up isolated on the edge of, you know, it's still running array technologies when most other companies have moved to distributed storage engines. So, but I do hear conflicting stories coming out about the EMC storage business where sometimes it says, you know, it's up amazingly and other stories which say it's shrinking, you know, which is a sure sign it's probably shrinking because any talk of it shrinking means it's actually shrinking because the rest of it's just, you know, exaggeration or lies with statistics most likely. And EMC, of course, was a company that was very big on long, big talk and big promises. And like to pretend that it was, you know, better than it actually was for many, many years, but ultimately ended up having to sell to Dell to survive.
That's right. Well, the Register reported on their earnings, and they say on the storage front, there's growth probably in hyperconverged and all-flash arrays, but, you know, sort of the traditional hybrid arrays that EMC built its business around, that may be the thing that's dragging the storage business down.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing that with all of the old legacy companies, they've got storage arrays. And I've talked about this many times on the podcast that some of them are sitting there on 50-year support contracts for those or 20 years or, you know, decade 10 plus 10 plus 10 sort of. They sell a storage array to a U.S. warship and they want to use the same storage array for 30 years, the life of the ship. Mm-hmm. And at the time that they took that, they committed to supporting that unit for that long. Because
they did take the money. They do
take
have
the
an
money.
Obligation.
Take the money. Yeah. There is no tomorrow when you're in sales. There's only today. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out.
Yeah, we'll always be back with more quarterly results, but that does bring us to the end of this episode. Greg, where can folks get more from you socially?
Yes, it's a short week this week. There wasn't much news going around, to be fair, so we did have to dig fairly hard to bring you something lovingly cared, curated, and of some interest. But you can find me on Twitter as @etherealmind. You can find me microblogging with little snippets of updates of news as I go through the week at etherealmind.com. And then, of course, I do write occasionally and publish some YouTube videos on the Packet Pushers YouTube channel.
That's right. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I'm on Twitter at @Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our sponsor, White Spider. And as always, thank you to you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, let people know on Facebook. You can leave a recommendation on iTunes. That really helps because Apple podcasts are big now. Or you can just share a link with your friends. You can check out our membership program. That's at packetpushers.net/members. It's free to sign up and you get the Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation newsletters thrown in. And thanks for listening.